This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. This is Books of the Year, but then you know that because you clicked on the podcast download thing. And we're here again. We are your friends at Books of the Year.
And it's a delight to be back.
Always, yes. Always a delight. Thanks very much for the correspondence. Big guest coming up. This is from Journeyman 2000. That's how it's signed. So, you know, maybe he's a spy or something. Yeah. She's a spy. Hello, you two. Thought I'd let you know about a recent charity shop splurge I had. I went there with the intention of giving them a pair of brand new dress shoes. Black leather, medium heel, never worn, since you asked, and not looking at the many shelves of books they have there.
Uh-huh.
I'd done quite well. Upon arrival, I walked directly to the back of the shop, not taking my eyes off the destination. Once there, a friendly volunteer took my shoebox, thanked me, and took them off to the back. Now for the challenge of getting back outside without buying anything. Well, I don't mind telling you, I made it all but three paces before a shiny book cover caught my eye. Oh, I'll just have a quick look, I thought. 10 minutes later, I had four books in my hands and I was headed over to the till to purchase my wares. I got a Jonathan Franzen novel called Purity, which I've been meaning to read for some time, a hardback no less, and three classics by Dickens. That's 27-0 to the charity shop. Thanks for the pod, says Ron. I thought at the end of Ron, oh, it's a Ron, okay, that he was going to say, and I saw TikTok and I thought,
yeah, and I thought that's the one for me.
But
I do remember
not.
That cover for Purity is very shiny and eye-catchy. It definitely works. So I can see why that leapt out of the bookshelves at you. An email from Deborah, who, of course, wrote to booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. Dear ordered alphabetically and ordered geographically.
Yes.
Big fan of the pod, loving your work. Thank you for the recent episode featuring Araminta Hall. I was unaware of her books, but after hearing her talk so brilliantly on your podcast, I went out to buy a copy of One of the Good Guys, and I have to say, I devoured it. Great story, great writing, a real page-turner. It's so nice to be introduced to an author you've never heard of before, so thank you. It seems there are three or four other novels by her available. I definitely want to read them. If you have any recommendations of where to go next, I'd be grateful. Keep up the good work. Deborah, the recommendations, that's the point of this podcast.
The whole podcast is recommendations
of book to go for.
The producer of this podcast, when he's in, because sometimes he's sort of away,
down the line, yeah, yeah,
says he's a big fan of Our Kind of Cruelty by Araminta Hall, and he recommends that one should you want an extra steer. Remember, if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at any time. We'd love to hear from you. booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Twitter at Books of the Year, Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page. Now we talk to novelist, former CIA agent or analyst, we'll have to get the precise term clarified for us. Previous Books of the Year star, David McCloskey. So in record time, we're welcoming back to the podcast best-selling author of Damascus Station, David McCloskey. I always get this wrong. David McCloskey. I don't usually get it wrong in front of David McCloskey. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm great to be here, Simon. Thank you so much for having me back.
Irish or Scottish in derivation?
Irish.
Okay.
Yeah, is my belief.
Now, last time when we spoke to you, it was the middle of the night. You were at home?
I was at home. I think if you had seen the background behind me, it would have been my bedroom. It was via Zoom, and yes. I think beneath me were a whole bunch of children's toys that I hid from the Zoom camera.
I remember thinking that there was something about you that was completely unbelievable, because you've written these astonishing books, you've been a spy, and at 4 a.m. you looked amazing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At this point we thought, this can't.
At least from the waist up, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. That's from the neck up, actually, as I recall. Anyways, very nice to, you're over in the UK, it's very nice to talk to you. Thanks for coming in. You must be bold. I mean, the response to this book is even stronger and more enthusiastic than Damascus, isn't it?
I think so. I hope so. Yeah, it's been exciting to see the reception over here, for sure, to both novels. And, you know, maybe a little surprising for an American spy author. But, you know, it's been wonderful, and I'm excited to actually be over here this time to promote it.
Just one question before we talk about the book. Do you ever stop being an analyst? Do you ever...
No.
Those skills are so sort of ingrained in you that, you know, if you walk into a room, or if you walk into a shopping center, or if you walk into a studio, do you ever stop thinking like you work for the CIA?
I don't think you ever stop being an analyst. I think it's more of a state of mind than it is a job. I think, you know, you do stop working for the CIA, so to some degree you kind of let pieces of that go, or at least I have. But I think the analytical mindset never really goes away. I think it's part of, you know,
analyzing people.
Everything. Analyzing people, situations, what's really going on in the world, you know, how is my book doing? All these kinds of things. You bring a particular
paranoid author.
That's paranoid author. I mean, paranoid author and analyst share a lot of similar traits.
I can answer that last question, because the answer is very well. Moscow X is the new book. Matt, describe the cover, please.
Yes, it is. It's thunderclouds gathering over Red Square in Moscow. So dark clouds take up the top half of the front cover, and then, as I say, the bottom half is Red Square with Basil's Cathedral in the background, and a murder of crows, I'm going to say, flying across there. Very good. Very good. Yeah. Moscow X in lime green, Dave McCloskey above it. Simon Sebag Montefiore, former guest on this podcast, saying it's thrilling, propulsive and terrifying, unputdownably superb. Well done, Simon. And the most authentic depiction of CIA deep cover operations you will find in print. And that comes from former CIA senior operations officer John. Now, I would love to say, is this John Cypher?
John Cypher, yes.
Is that literally his name? Is John Cypher?
That is literally his name.
And he works for the CIA.
And he worked for the CIA.
Like a Barry code word.
He was born
it's
to
amazing.
Work. For, he was born to work for the CIA.
Wow.
With a name like that. That's right.
Is that nominative determinism?
I think it is.
Is that what that is?
I think it is.
Okay. So, it's also, not only is it a great title, because you go, having heard what Matt has just said, describe the cover, you look at the title, you go, yes, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So we can dispense with this interview. But what is Moscow X?
So Moscow X is a fictional component of the CIA's very real Russia house in the novel. It's kind of CIA lingo, I guess, that if you have the X after something, that is typically a station in exile.
So what does that mean?
That means if you, let's say in Tehran, let's say your embassy is overrun and the CIA has to set up operations outside of that country, the place would be called Tehran X, and that would be located outside of Iran in a third party country. In this case, you know, I don't go into specifics around the station in Moscow being closed, but I liked the mentality of that. And I wanted to create a kind of fictional component of our Russia operations that could do, frankly, pretty wild stuff. So Moscow X of the novel is really charged with taking this kind of outside-the-box, aggressive approach to dealing with the Russians. I thought it fit as a title, worked as the name of the component, got the spirit of the operation I wanted to run in the book just right. And it's run in the novel by this sort of also deranged and colorful CIA case officer named Artemis Proctor.
Yes, Artemis Aphrodite.
That's
Proctor.
Right. Yeah, right. Her full Christian name.
Yes. Astonishing. Yeah. An astonishing name. Is this a sequel to Damascus Station?
No. Ish. It is. You could read it on its own. Okay. But there is some character overlap. I would say it exists in the same universe as Damascus Station. It takes place in the present day. Damascus Station took place in the early years of the Syrian Civil War. So there's certainly... there's a continuity here from character standpoint. The events of Damascus Station are referred to offhand in this novel, but it is not we don't pick up where we left off, and we don't have the same set of characters. We have, with the exception of Proctor and the deputy director of the CIA in this novel, who was the chief of the Near East Division in Damascus Station, we have kind of a blank slate of new people.
So introduce us then, for newcomers, to Artemis Aphrodite Proctor.
So she was the chief of station in Damascus Station. And in this novel, she's running Moscow X. She is the case officer that I think many of us hope and wish exists somewhere inside CIA. We would never want to work for her. She could never work at a normal place, which is why she's ended up at CIA. She's competent. She has a foul, she's got a pouty mouth, let's say. And she both abuses her people and loves them at the same time. And so she is a kind of character, I think, who as a writer, you hope you find, because you put her in a scene and you don't know what's going to happen. You know, I mean, in the first, I know it's not a spoiler to say, in the first few pages of this novel, she has woken up drugged by a Russian intelligence officer, been shown pictures that the Russians have taken of her indiscreetly.
Yeah, she's not wearing any clothes.
And she's clubbed someone over the head with a bottle of horse milk. And, you know, none of this, I have to say, this is why I love this character so much. None of this stuff came really from me. At least it doesn't feel that way. I sat down to write a scene. I didn't know what was going to happen. And that's what she did. So that's the type of character she
is.
That's
not much of a defense, is it? I didn't, honestly, officer, I didn't know what was going to happen. It just came out of my pen.
I can take no responsibility for her actions as the author.
She's a thrilling character, and I loved her in Damascus Station, and I loved her in Moscow X. And Moscow X, by the way, is what a piece of work this book is. I absolutely loved it. This is not going to be a question really about the book as such. It's more of a plea, really, which is that. So I tend to hear this criticism of fictional books mainly from men, which is I don't read fiction because it's made up. I read nonfiction because I want to hear about facts and blah blah blah, but fiction I don't bother with because it's all made up. And I get that, and I know I can sympathize with that. However, here's where it's wrong. Is there is a part very earlier in the book, one of our characters who we've not really talked about yet, Anna, who's a central character in this book, fires an AK-47. Now, those of us who know anything about AK-47s know it's named after the guy who invented it. 47, I don't know what the 47 means, whether it was the year it was invented or the number of rounds it fires. It doesn't matter.
David will know.
It's the year.
Yeah. It's the year. Okay, yeah. So it's the year. It's named after the guy who invented it. And that the reason it's so popular is it will work in virtually any conditions and you can throw it in the dirt and it still fires. What you don't know is how it feels to fire an AK-47, and that's what you have Anna doing. And it was when I read that one sequence of Anna firing an AK-47 that I thought, this is what you get from a fictional book that you don't get from non-fiction. This, and it's a real thing happening, but it spoke to a part of me that says, I'm so glad that I do read the amount of fiction I do, because whether it's made up or not, the feel is what you can't get from nonfiction.
I think there is something to that for sure. I mean, it's honestly why I was attracted to writing fiction to begin with, is you get down to that level of what's actually going on inside someone's brain, their physiology, their emotional state. You know, Damascus Station came out of a desire on my part to just write about Syria and not to do it from the lens of here's the 30,000-foot view of U.S. policy or what the CIA had been doing or whatever, but to get down to the level of, well, here's how individual people encountered this conflict and how that led to all kinds of different experiences and perspectives on the war and relationships to the Assad regime or to the United States or whatever. And I think in this book, it was a way to understand, I mean, through Anna's character, let's say, a way to understand or try to get under the hood of what is it like to live inside Putin's system as a relatively well-off Russian. I mean, I don't think that's a perspective that a lot of us can really understand. But, you know, getting at that through the lens of a fictional character, firing an AK-47, being an intelligence officer, living inside Russia today, you know, it is hard, I think, if you're writing, you know, a history of Russia or whatever, you don't often get down to that level, or it's harder. I think novels allow that.
Is anyone, as a sidebar, anyone who doesn't read fiction because it's made up is an idiot? I mean,
no, we all know that. This is,
to which I would say, Godfather, did you see that? Mary Poppins, did you see that? Star Wars, did you see any of that? Guess what? All made up. James Bond, you don't go and see that. Interstellar, don't you? I mean, that's madness.
It
do you know
madness.
People who say that?
I do know people who
well,
say that.
Well, you tell
yes.
them
I will,
they're
I will
fools.
Tell them that, yeah.
And, they're miss- them that. And they're absolutely missing out. Very early on, we also meet Lieutenant Colonel Chernov of the FSB, which is the Russian equivalent of the CIA. And he, we learn, was a soldier and priest. Mm. And when he talks about God speaking through Russia alone, so therefore laws come from God, and therefore this gold, which I'm now going to help myself to, actually belongs to God. I mean, that's a very useful kind of...
It is.
Sorry, I've got to take this, but it belongs to God. Where did that come from? I mean, it sounds like every country has its own exceptionalism.
Right.
Our country, your country, and clearly Russia does as well. Where did you come across the idea of God speaking through Russia alone? I was just fascinated by that.
So I wanted his character to be very terrifying, if I could. And I wanted him also, I did not want him to be, at the same time, I was sort of struggling with this as I was crafting him or trying to find him as a character. How do you make a terrifying Russian intelligence officer not a cartoon, hopefully? Mm. You know, because I think we've all read and you know, books or seen movies where you have that evil Russian villain who also you kind of know in the back of your head, even if they're entertaining, like this person bears no resemblance to reality. What I did for him to try to overcome that, and hopefully I have, is I read some philosophy from Ivan Illion, who is a sort of fascist, Russian fascist philosopher from the 19-teens and 20s, and who has been kind of resurrected by Putin and some of the people around him, who has this view, it's very hard to read the stuff and understand what in the heck this guy was saying. But he has this view of Russia as a salvific force and Russia as being sort of the way that God redeems the world. And as a result, Russian state power is sort of sovereign and holy and can do no wrong. And I thought if I combine this with my character who, you know, sees himself on this sort of holy mission, you'd have some interesting stuff to work with there, because all of a sudden he's not bound by any sort of typical view of morality, ethics, interpersonal relationships, if he really believes this stuff, which he does. And so that permits him to, he can take gold, he can kill people, you know, all in the name of really these ideals that he sees as being, you know, holy and above the world.
We can't really talk about Russia without talking about Putin. And Putin does. I literally finished this book on the tube on the way here. And so no spoilers, but Putin does feature in sort of a brief scene towards the end. He's referred to during the book as, and I'm going to mispronounce this, it's Kozian?
Hozian. Yeah.
Hozian.
And I'm probably butchering it a little bit too.
Okay.
But yeah, Hozian.
But even though he, as I say, he features briefly in one scene, but he is often referred to throughout the book. And there's a great sequence where one of your characters is describing how the Russian rich, how they view Putin.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not entirely complimentary. And so I basically what I'm doing is inviting you now to tell us that bit in the book where they are talking about how they view Putin and how it's a little nuanced.
Yeah, I think... you know, outside the system, I think we have this view that he's universally feared and respected inside. And there are elements of truth to that. There's fear and respect that's built into the system. He couldn't survive in power without it. At the same time, you have this, you know, a system where people laugh at him behind his back, where he is all powerful in one sense, and then in the other, he's sort of not able to make things happen inside the bureaucracy. So I think there is a tension or some paradox built into the power structure. At the same time, you know, power in Russia is very centralized. It sort of moves out from him, I think I say this in the book, in rings, you know. So the further you are, literally in proximity to his office or his person, the less power you have. And as soon as that system starts to feel under stress, or that maybe there's less power there than we thought, things start to move around it to try to reconsolidate or take, you know, just selfishly take more power, take more turf if you can get away with it. So it's a much more complex system, I think, than we see from the outside. And it's one that in the novel I take advantage of, because you do have these factions that are competing. And I try to show that explicitly in the book. I think from the outside, we tend to see the outcomes of those spats. You know, someone falls off a third-story balcony in Moscow. Someone, you know, falls in front of a moving car. We see that, but we don't see the buildup to that and the interplay between the personalities that leads to that kind of outcome. All, I think, sort of symptomatic of the way power in Russia is handled.
When you're writing about Russia, obviously, you run the risk of news overtaking your own story. So obviously the war in Ukraine continues, a hideous, brutal war, an imperialistic war from Putin, essentially. And then, because there's one of the themes of the book is a coup against, or the possibility of a coup against Putin.
Right.
We looked as though that's what we were watching for a while, just a few months back. Did you watch those and think, I'm going to have to go back and change anything?
It's a weird feeling to be watching potential moves against Putin and to feel like, oh man, I hope this guy doesn't get tossed. You know?
I need him. Like, I'm rooting for Putin.
Me and Putin are on the same team today because I don't want to have to edit this thing again. Which was a legitimate, when I woke up that day and saw that, I thought, oh boy, you know, this is bad. Because I think at that point, the book was almost to the printers in the States, and I think my editor there would have murdered me if I had tried to suggest more changes. We'd already been through a round of this, though, because, you know, on the cusp of the sort of proper, you know, invasion in February of 22, I had literally just finished the first draft that my U.S. editor had read. And throughout the kind of November, December, January buildup, where it was becoming apparent that something was going to happen, I was like, I'm gonna have to go back and render all the scenes in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Now, some scenes required more changes than others, but I couldn't draw Russia without, you know, the war being present. And I had to go and actually change some of the stuff in the beginning of the book, because I felt like getting to the actual guts of the operation that the CIA undertakes, well, you know, we were sort of already at a point where it was possible to imagine the agency doing it. I didn't need some of the preamble that had existed in earlier drafts to get us there. So in some ways, it kind of streamlined things. I could take that stuff out. We just get right into it. But it was, you know, at the time, it was looking like it was going to be kind of a mess editorially, because I just had to go back and rework a decent amount of it.
Is it Proctor who, in talking about the battle between America and Russia, calls it a fight without end?
Yes, yes.
That felt as though that was coming into our world as well. That felt like that's how you view this thing, that whatever happens, whoever wins the American presidency, I mean, we know who's going to win the Russian election for president there, but it's a fight without end.
I use Proctor. I think there's a couple points in the book where her very colorful and profane speeches or monologues about Russian power or geopolitics or the U.S.-Russia competition, I think, reflect my own views. And this would be one of them, where, you look at two countries that have very, as you mentioned, exceptional views of themselves, and who are constantly in conflict. How does this, you know, in the 90s, you know, we sort of lived in this strange reality where the Russians, they were so weak that we thought, well, it'll eventually be the case that we'll just sort of merge them into our system. And they will exist as a quote-unquote normal country inside the sort of U.S.-dominated global order. You know, well, surprise, Putin and the people around him who come out of the you know, KGB and you know, this sort of St. Petersburg mafia around, they don't view Russia as a normal country. They don't view it as a component of, you know, the U.S.-led global order. They view it as something wholly different. And we're now seeing the sort of outcome of that. So I don't think there's sort of a way in which the U.S. and Russia exist
unless President
together
Trump,
normally.
You know, a future President Trump decides to go, hey, that Putin guy, you know, we have lots in common. We like each other. You know, maybe we should get together.
God help us. I mean, you know.
Sure.
I think even then, the idea that the United States and Russia can, it's not that there aren't areas where we could cooperate. I think it's just that, you know, you look at the sort of full expression of Russian power and how it sort of defines its role in the world and the territorial space in which it should have a veto power. And I don't really see how we can coexist with that in its fullest expression. I really don't.
Anyone who picks up your books, David, is going to take it as a given that we're on solid ground as far as geopolitics is concerned, as far as espionage is concerned, and all of those things. What I wasn't expecting was the etiquette lesson in how to behave around rich Russians, which happens in I love this bit. And I always have one sequence, one batch of questions I ask authors when they come in about, is this made up or is this actually true?
And so, and they're always made up.
They're always made up, but I'm so dumb. I always am convinced that it's true. So this is the etiquette when dealing with Russians. Always look people in the eye. Good posture. Don't put your hands in your pockets. Eat more than you should. But some tidbits were useful. Don't show the bottom of your feet. Point with your whole hand, never your finger. Men should use a bone-crushing handshake. Do not whistle indoors. And leave a little food on your plate to show that you've been satisfied. Are those things true or did you make them up?
So as far as I know, they're true.
Oh,
and I subjected myself to etiquette lessons from a number of Russians because I said, look, this is going to sound strange because I'm writing a spy novel, but I want you to tell me, if I'm in very upper crust Russians, how should I behave and what are some things that you should not do? And so, you know, this was the list that came out of those conversations and lessons. Now, you might have a Russian listener who disagrees, and I'm open to that. But as far as I know, these are true.
Never whistle indoors.
Never whistle indoors. I'll be very curious if you get a listener that says differently, though. But this was what I was told.
Just on the and the people that you thank in the credits, because Matt has mentioned Russian etiquette. You mentioned a former FSB officer, mm-hmm. Jan Neumann. And I'm thinking, okay, this is, I mean, obviously fantastic contacts that you've got, but you can credit a former FSB. We know the way Putin operates with people who are former FSB. Is that a made up name?
No. I asked him. I said, you know, look, he'd been very helpful. He read drafts and we've had meetings, conversations to kind of go over many points of this book, because I did feel at some point like I was trying to find somebody who'd been inside the system, not just, you know, inside the Russian government, but in one of the security services, and came upon him through some contacts, and he's been remarkably helpful and helped me on the third book. And I said, how do you want to be credited? And he said, just put my name in the book.
By the way, Red Draft would be a good name for your next book.
Red Draft.
also, and you can spell draft a number of ways. And it means all different things. The other person that I just wanted to mention is that Matt and I both worked with Gordon Carrera when we were at the BBC, BBC security correspondent. He's written books himself. He's a fascinating guy. But you thank him for pointing out that Brits don't eat candy and that houses in St. Ives don't have
ceiling fans.
Yeah, I forgot what they call. In fact, most places in Britain don't have ceiling fans. That's top info. You've got a bit of intel there.
I'll tell you, as a novelist, you start. I mean, you know, I send the books and have many CI officers who will read them and provide comments on the tradecraft. And I was going through the editing process on this one, I thought, you know, I need to have somebody who has some recent experience in Cornwall just read these drafts to tell me, did I get basic things wrong? And he, you know, he read them. He's like, I don't think I've ever seen a ceiling fan anywhere. to your point, yeah. Like anywhere kind of in Britain. And I thought that seems right. It was, you know, in Damascus Station, I think because a couple of the embassy kind of affiliated residences had them, I was like, okay, it's normal to have a dishwasher in a Syrian home. Well, no.
No.
It's not. And I had, you know, an intrepid reader sent me an email a few months after the book came out and said, I really love the rendering of Damascus, except for the dishwasher. and so you've got to, you know, there's a certain, we talked about author paranoia earlier. I mean, that's the level of the paranoia here is like, I'm going to render something that seems so inane that I don't even think about it, but you know, I'm going to get an irate email from somebody that's like, well, you know what? There's no ceiling fans here. What are you talking about?
Have you ever been to St. Ives?
No.
It's the most amazing. You'll never come back. That sounds sinister.
Yes, it does. That does. I don't think I'm going to go now, Simon.
It's the most beautiful part of Cornwall. You will absolutely love it. Yeah. It is an absolutely fantastic place. We touched on this last time you came in, but just help us out on what you can't say. So obviously you can't say specifically what you can't say, but your inner code must think, I can't do that. I can't say that. I can't have my characters behave like that because I'm giving too much away.
Mm.
Is there anything?
This is a good way to ask the question to get me to say things I shouldn't say. that's some excellent tradecraft. So I think when it gets down to it, there's actually less than you would think that you can't say. Really what it comes down to is sources and methods. So anything that I would write in a book, fiction, nonfiction, whatever, that would be identifying of an actual human or a collection method, no way. And so if I were to put, you know, Syrian, Russian, whatever, if I were to sort of fictionalize an actual human, but it's kind of clear who it was, you know, that would be, I'm not even sure that the CIA would, like the people reading it would necessarily catch that. But to me, it would be just no way. I couldn't do that. I think the other thing would be, you know, particular pieces of tradecraft that are not in the open domain and that, you know, I'd consider to be proprietary or otherwise, like that would be irresponsible of me to include, even if I could find some way to sort of sneak it through the publication review board. And so I really, there is an element of self-censoring that happens that I don't think detracts from the storytelling, but that I feel like is important just given, you know, that I was inside for a little while and have contacts who, you know things that are not in the public domain.
Are there any events that you covered or witnessed that you haven't been able to bring yourself to put in your books? Obviously, and again, if there are, you're not going to tell, but that's the whole point of not saying, but I just wonder if there are some things, actual events that you think, I'm going to leave that alone.
I think more from the standpoint of not feeling like I could maybe, you know, Damascus Station, some of the events in that novel, I did hold back from kind of going in as much depth as I maybe could have, more from just it was hard for me to, the war is still kind of a hard subject for me in some respects emotionally, because of the sheer amount of human chaos and tragedy and suffering. It's less from sources and methods, CIA stuff, and it's more just, would I really be able to render this effectively? I don't know. It's more on that level, I think, than any kind of CIA stuff.
I kind of know the answer to this, and Matt has mentioned it before you came in, that you have an incredible work ethic. You seem to be able to, I don't know how you were as an analyst, but as a writer, you are so far ahead of everyone else that we've ever spoken to. Moscow X is the book that we're talking about. And next from you?
So next is, so it's done. Third book's
done. Of course
done.
It, of course,
of course it,
it
is.
It's called The Seventh Floor. And it is...
It's not called Red Draft.
It's not called Red Draft. Although I might steal that. I'm going to take that. That's a good one to have in the hopper. It is a Mole Hunt. So it's a bit of a modern homage to Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy.
From the new John le Carré, I see. Yeah.
And which that book is... It is my favorite spy novel ever. It has been for since I read it. And it is Artemis Proctor back in the George Smiley role. There's a Russian asset at the highest levels of Langley. Who is it? That's essentially the book. So she's back. She's George Smiley. And Sam Joseph from Damascus Station is back as her henchman to root this mole out. I had a tremendous amount of fun with that book because the mole hunt is a little bit of a different structure. It's more of a whodunit in some respects. Mm-hmm. So as the author, you're trying to retain that mystery throughout while giving clues.
Misdirection.
Along the way, who is it? You know, you've got your sort of cast of suspects. Which one of them is it? Give them all some motive. Make them all a little bit suspicious. There's a wonderful... I did a extensive research trip to Las Vegas for this novel where I went with a friend of mine who's a serious gambler and spent about, 3 days there just sort of seeing his life. So I've got some stuff in Vegas. There's some stuff in an alligator-themed amusement park in Central Florida.
Okay.
And some stuff in Moscow in southern France.
Okay, and then after that book, you on the next one?
I'm on to the next one. I'm about halfway into the next one.
I feel so depressed.
But it's very early days on that one. There's no...
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's
only 500,000 words. Or something. So the new book from David McCloskey is Moscow X. It is fantastic. It is extraordinary. You need to read them as a primer for those next two books because those next two books are going to be out like in a couple of months' time. Probably. There will be more conversation with David in our Q&A, which will be with you in a few days' time. For the moment, David, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been tons of fun.